Good afternoon. The Labor, Industry, Veterans, Military Affairs, Finance, and Policy Committee will come to order. I would like to announce that this meeting will take place in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This meeting may be viewed on House Public Information TV, which is available on House website. As is customary with this committee, please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance. Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, liberty, and justice for all. Mr. Petrie, please take the roll.
Chair Eklund.
Present.
Chair Eklund, present. Representative Zhang.
Present.
Representative Zhang. Present. Representative Detmer.
Present.
Representative Detmer, present. Representative McDonald.
McDonald, present.
Representative McDonald, present. Representative Berg.
Present.
Representative Berg, present. Representative Bliss.
Present.
Representative Bliss, present. Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Edelson, present. Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Frederick, present. Representative Greenman.
Present.
Representative Greenman, present. Representative Nelson.
Nelson, present.
Representative Nelson, present. Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Poston, present. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, present.
Representative Raleigh, present. Representative Sundin.
Present.
Representative Sundin, present. And Mr. Chair, we do have a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Petrie. A quorum is present. Next on the agenda is approval of minutes from March 9th, 2022. Representative Edelson, did you get a chance to look at the minutes?
I did, and I'll move those minutes.
Representative Edelson moves the minutes from March 9th, 2022. Any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion minutes are adopted. Members, we have four bills on the agenda today. I will be leaving after the third one. I have a large group of constituents in town. The fourth bill is informational, so the Vice Chair Zhang will be taking over after the first three bills we have. First bill is from Representative Long, House File 4184. I move to refer House File 4184 to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Welcome, Representative Long. Please introduce your bill.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. So I'll have a question to start the committee. What do Buffalo Wild Wings, Jiffy Lube, and Jackson Hewitt tax preparers have in common? They are all franchises that once used anti-competitive no-poach agreements in their franchise contracts. No-poach clauses in the franchise context prohibit one franchise from hiring the employees of another. These types of agreements, it is clear now, are illegal, and this bill would simply prohibit this language in franchise agreements in Minnesota. No poach clauses are designed to keep worker wages low by not allowing workers to move their labor. How are workers able to bargain for better wages if they can't use the skills they've earned to work elsewhere? This is a distinctly anti-competitive practice. And that's why I refer to it as illegal. The Department of Justice, in fact, has sued many companies that were using no poach clauses. And state attorneys general have also settled with 100 fast food chains to remove no poach language, as Attorney General Ellison will discuss. So now it's time for Minnesota law to catch up as well. Many franchises are voluntarily dropping these provisions from their franchise contracts. But for those that don't, Minnesota should be able to enforce against those companies for this harmful practice, and it should be clear that it is against Minnesota law. With that, Mr. Chair, I have two testifiers to this bill.
Thank you, Representative Long. First testifier is Keith Ellison, Attorney General, State of Minnesota. Mr. Attorney General, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Keith Ellison. I'm the Attorney General for the State of Minnesota. And I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, for inviting me here and having me testify today on House File 4184, and I would like to thank Representative Long for his leadership on this, and it is a critically important piece of legislation which we fully support. Being able to change jobs easily is one of the best tools you have to help you afford your life. If you're underpaid, if you're treated badly or poorly, if you have no opportunity for advancement in your job, then getting a new job is the thing to do. That's what we tell everybody. You don't like this job, get another job. Even if you don't actually move, the fact that you could move makes it clear that you could have the leverage to negotiate better pay and benefits with your employer. But what if you can't? Because the only other player in the industry has already, there's been a no poach agreement where the employers have agreed that they don't hire each other's employees. So you basically are stuck where you are. You know, the fact is that the market should be fluid. The market should be competitive, even for labor. But so often, it isn't that way. Sometimes, employers put provisions in their contracts that make it harder for some workers to move to new jobs. They even try to suppress pay and restrict competition to get an unfair advantage over their employees. House File 4184, which would ban no poach agreements, no hire clauses, is an important step toward creating a more equal playing field between employers and employees, which is the way the market should work. The way no poach and no hire clauses usually work is that a franchisee agrees not to hire from other stores in the same franchise chain. For example, one McDonald's franchise couldn't hire a current or former employees from McDonald's restaurants. Sometimes they exist across chains as well. Some no poach, no hire clauses prohibit hirings for months or years after an employee leaves their previous job. So, for example, we know that the real no poach agreement, no hire agreement that McDonald's used prohibited hiring employees if they had worked at a different McDonald's within the last 6 months. The parties who agree to these clauses are the franchisor, meaning that the corporate headquarters and the franchisee, meaning the owner of the franchise. Now, the important thing to know is that even though these clauses affect employees, employees don't agree to them. These clauses are not part of the employee's contract. The employees never see or even know about these provisions. This means that your employer has one of these contracts under the current state of the law. You can't even do anything about it. Actually, we believe you can. They're not legal. But when they exist, you may not know that. But they are, these contracts are very prevalent. Dozens of popular fast food restaurants use them now or used to use them recently, from Buffalo Wild Wings to Domino's to Culver's to Jimmy John's. Outside of the fast food industry, gyms, hotels, salons, tax preparation businesses have used them too. Now, you think that operators would want to hire workers from other locations in the same franchise chain. Those workers would be well qualified and require little training. Instead, no poach, no hire agreements help franchise owners keep wages down or workers and profits up. If you're an employee, these clauses don't just hurt your wages and your ability to get ahead. They can trap you in a job where you're mistreated, taken advantage of. You might be stuck working excessive hours. You might be stuck with a manager who sexually harasses you, real case. You might be stuck having your wages stolen. Also, cases we've seen. Your only choice might be to leave the industry you're working in altogether. In short, no poach, no hire clauses reward bad employers by giving them more power to keep their employees and punishes good employees by preventing them from moving elsewhere so they can get better pay and better treatment. You may be aware that the attorneys general from across the country, including here in Minnesota, have been investigating no poach, no hire agreements for years. The Minnesota Attorney General's offices, my office, has gotten Arby's, Dunkin' Donuts, Five Guys, Little Caesars, and Panera to sign agreements that they will no longer use no poach hire clauses. House File 4184 is necessary because it makes it these clauses are legal in writing. It is explicitly does so. Under current antitrust law, if two different restaurants that directly compete signed a no poach agreement with each other, it would be clearly illegal and this bill wouldn't be necessary. But with no poach clauses, franchisees don't sign the deals with other franchisees. They sign the deal with the franchisor and the owner of the whole restaurant chain. It's called a hub and spoke conspiracy. And the hub is the corporate headquarters, and each spoke is an individual franchise. This way, the individual spokes can claim that their conduct is not technically illegal, even though the clear effect of the franchise is that the franchise owners are colluding with other franchise owners. House File 4184 is necessary to make this conduct clearly and unambiguously illegal. Passing House File 4184 will help Minnesotans find jobs where they're respected, treated well, and paid enough to afford their lives. And if they aren't, they can find another job much more easily. So let's stop protecting bad owners and start protecting good employees instead. So I thank you all for listening. And again, I want to thank Representative Long for bringing this bill forward.
Thank you, Attorney General Ellison. Next up is Evan Starr, Associate Professor of Management and Organization, Robert H. Smith School of Business at the University of Maryland. Mr. Starr, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Evan Starr, and I'm an associate professor at the University of Maryland in the Robert H. Smith School of Business. I'd like to thank Representative Long, the chairman, and the rest of the committee for having me here today. No poach agreements are something that we're hearing about only in about the last 5 years. And that's largely because in the franchise context, we just learned about them. Orly Ashenfelter and Alan Krueger, the late Alan Krueger, published a study just recently based on survey of data in 2016 found that 60% of franchises prohibited the franchisors from poaching each other's workers. And as A.G. Ellison just described, these are important because these are contracts that workers are entirely unaware of. They are organization-level agreements that that the workers don't know about. And so you can imagine a situation where a worker's life changes, and maybe they work at a McDonald's, and they'd like to move to a different McDonald's that maybe is closer to their kid's school. And maybe they're excited because they have the most relevant skills to be a manager or a burger flipper at the next McDonald's that's a lot closer and better for their life. And so they supply that information on an application. And to their chagrin, they don't realize that by supplying the most relevant work information you could possibly have for those sorts of jobs, they are, in fact, prohibiting themselves from getting that job opportunity because of these no-poach agreements. And so I think the key takeaway here is that these are restrictions on worker mobility. And that's what I've been studying for the last decade or so. And I want to highlight another recent study here because it's difficult to have market-wide estimates about how much these agreements hurt workers. And so you can imagine the effects on employee mobility are pretty clear, but less clear is going to be the effects on wages. And I just want to highlight a recent study, which is in a different context but is relevant here, which is the context of the Silicon Valley no-poach case, which you've probably heard about, which the DOJ investigated in 2009. And in this case, Google and Apple and several other tech companies agreed not to hire each other's workers. And a study of the wage data from that case, looking at the firms that agreed not to poach each other's workers and a set of firms who weren't party to those contracts, found that just a single no-poach agreement with another organization reduced workers' wages by on average 2.5%. And so as A.G. Ellison said, this is not just a matter of theory that we're talking about in terms of reducing worker mobility and hurting wages. The evidence is also there. I want to highlight one other important distinction here, which is that when people talk about motivations for no poach agreements, they'll often say things like, "Well, the firm needs it to protect their investments in the worker training." They'll say that they need it to protect their investments in whatever legitimate business interest they might conjure up. And I think the appropriate response to that is skepticism, because the question is, why would you have to go over the worker's head to protect those interests? If you want to protect an interest in worker training, for example, then you can ask the worker to sign a training repayment agreement that says that if you're going to provide $5,000 of training, and if they leave before that training is paid back, then they have to pay some proportion of the initial outlay and expenses. why would you have to protect training by going over the workers' head not to poach workers? And that holds for every other legitimate interest you could possibly think of. There's no reason that if you're trying to protect those interests that you wouldn't ask the worker about restrictions on their own mobility. And so I want to close by just noting that this is very similar to non-compete agreements. The difference is that non-compete agreements here are actually at least signed by the worker, and you could at least go talk to a lawyer about it. In this situation, the workers really have no recourse. So I want to thank Representative Long for the opportunity to be here and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Starr. Any comments or questions from members? I don't see any. Representative Long, closing comments, final comments.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. I think the two testifiers did a great job of outlining this issue, and I'll just emphasize that these are not agreements that the workers themselves are entering into. So they have no ability to bargain on these issues, and they are also often left out in the cold if they want to move their labor and try to find another job with the employer whose experience they are most relevant for. So I think this is a fundamental issue of fairness and should be a very clear distinction in Minnesota law. So I ask for member support.
Thank you, Chair Long. I renew my motion that House File 4184 be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Mr. Petrie, please take the roll.
Chair Eklund.
Yes.
Chair Eklund, yes. Representative Zhang.
Yes.
Representative Zhang, yes. Representative Detmer.
Yes.
Representative Detmer, yes. Representative McDonald.
McDonald, no.
Representative McDonald, no. Representative Berg.
Yes.
Representative Berg, yes. Representative Bliss.
No.
Representative Bliss, no. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Representative Edelson, aye. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Representative Frederick, aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Representative Greenman, aye. Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Nelson, aye. Representative Poston.
Aye.
Representative Poston, aye. Representative
Raleigh, aye.
Representative Raleigh, aye. Representative Sundin. Mr. Chair,
aye.
Representative Sundin, aye. Mr. Chair, we have 11 ayes and 2 nays.
11 ayes and 2 nays. House File 4184 is on its way to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. Next up, we have a bill from Representative Edelson, House File 3010. Members, we have a bit of a time crunch today on this bill, so please reserve your comments to Section 1 of the bill, which is under the purview of this committee. Welcome, Representative Edelson. I'll get your name right. I apologize. Please move and introduce your bill.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move House File 3010 to be referred to Judiciary.
Representative Edelson moves that House File 3010 be referred to Judiciary. To your bill, Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3010 would prohibit that sexual harassment settlements can be paid as severance when a non-disclosure agreement is included. And in the instance when severance continues to be paid for these settlements, it provides language in Subdivision 2, which I know we're not supposed to talk about, that the sexual harassment and abuse claims should not be taxed by the Minnesota Department of Revenue. The key difference in this legislation is how it impacts employees who are the victims of sexual harassment and how the status quo can benefit companies. It is important to think about the two different paths. In the instance of sexual harassment, in both of these instances, sexual harassment has been established and an NDA has been signed. With severance as a settlement, the victim is subjected to paying state tax on the sum as it looks like wages. In the instance of severance, victims experience further victimizations financially because the amount that they received is dramatically reduced based on their tax rate. And it allows the company to deduct attorney's fees. With a settlement, the victim receives more of an award, and as the Minnesota does not tax these settlements. In both scenarios, the trauma and harassment may be exactly the same. In both scenarios, the benefit of resolving their harassment claim outside of a courtroom is there, thereby saving costly litigation. However, it is a tale of two stories with unequal outcomes. What we are talking about is a loophole in the law that benefits companies at the cost of victims of sexual harassment. It takes an attorney 1 minute to change the wording from settlement to severance. Then this can further traumatize a victim financially while benefiting that company. We should not accept this. NDAs can conceal bullying, toxic harassment in a workplace. We as a state should ensure that employees who become victims are protected. Companies, for good reason, across the nation are receiving scrutiny based on NDA cover-ups. These NDAs buy silence. By making these changes before you today, we can help create a safer workplace and ensure companies are having robust discussions to prevent harassment and abuse in the workplace. Mr. Chair, this issue came before me because a constituent was impacted by this, and I would like to move to my testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. First testifier is Julie Reiser. Ms. Reiser, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you, Representative Edelson, for moving this bill forward. My name is Julie Risser. In 2014, I signed a non-disclosure agreement with my previous employer for sexual harassment. Back then, I didn't know NDAs really aren't regulated. I didn't have time to investigate. My husband and I needed my job to support our family, but my job was toxic. This was before high-profile sexual harassment cases made headlines. I felt that I was isolated. I went through common stages of on-the-job harassment. I ignored my harasser, hoping it would stop. I told my harasser to knock it off. The employee handbook messaged zero tolerance for sexual harassment and that victims must report. I reported in annual reports year after year. Nothing happened. I went to HR. The rep refused to document my experience. Later, I learned from the state of Minnesota unemployment trainer, don't go to HR. HR protects the employer. Zero tolerance means HR denies sexual harassment. My contract is not renewed. It's common for people who report to lose their jobs, while those who harass remain employed, get promoted, and gain power over even more people. I hired an attorney. I didn't want anybody to go through what I had, and it seemed like the responsible thing to do. We reached an agreement. The term in it was settlement, not severance. There was nothing about income taxes. When payment came, I was stunned. It was a sliver of the validation I had agreed to, and even the state of Minnesota got a cut. My unemployment benefits stopped. I couldn't use settlement funds to retrain. My expertise was narrow. I would have had to move out of state for a job that matched my skills. That wasn't an option. My parents live here. We've been here for seven generations, my family. My employer benefited. Paying settlement as severance enables employers to ignore victims, harassment, and risk. It re-victimizes and shores up systemic gender inequities. I vividly remember looking at my statement and seeing the cut Minnesota got from my settlement. It was really a very unsettling time. House File 3010 will stop others from having this experience. Minnesota can do better by victims of sexual harassment. Thank you for your consideration of this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Risser, and I apologize for mispronouncing your name.
No problem.
Next up is, I might get this one wrong too, Artica Roller, Executive Director, Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Ms. Roller, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Artica Roller. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, also known as MNCASA. We are a statewide coalition that represents more than 66 programs who are providing direct service to domestic violence and sexual assault victims across all 87 counties of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Edelson, and the members of the committee for allowing me the opportunity to testify regarding House File 3010. I am testifying in support of House File 3010, the sexual harassment of abuse settlement payment that prohibits payment to be made as severance and state income tax subtraction allowed for damages received. Sexual harassment in the workplace is a serious issue and must be dealt with as such. Victims and survivors are often forced to quit their jobs because their safety and well-being are in jeopardy. Experiencing sexual harassment in the workplace can cause significant emotional pain and trauma to victims. people who have lost their jobs or left their jobs over the harassment are dealing with loss of wages, mounting medical bills, therapy, may even prefer the guarantee of settlement money. In addition, settlements can seem like the best chance for a victim to get justice and put that experience behind them. As Ms. Reiser stated, severance payments can further harm victims instead of settlement payments. Victims and survivors, settlement payments allow employers to hide what has actually happened and the wrongdoing that has occurred in their organization. MnCASA strongly supports House File 3010 in a sexual harassment or abuse settlement between an employer and an employee, where the financial settlement is provided. The financial settlement cannot be used as wages or severance payment to the employee when a non-disclosure statement or agreement has been made. Again, I thank you for the opportunity to testify regarding House File 3010.
Thank you, Ms. Roller. Next up, we have Caitlin Ryan, Chief Strategy Officer of RISE. Ms. Ryan, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for allowing me to address you today. My name is Caitlin Ryan. I was born in St. Paul and grew up in Lindstrom, Minnesota. I also joined today on behalf of my organization, RISE. On January 21st, 2017, I helped organize the largest single-day mass protest in the history of the United States. The Women's March brought together women and allies from all backgrounds, political persuasions, and religions from all around the world to stand together against misogyny, violence, and hatred. For many, the Women's March helped us feel a little less alone and a little bit stronger. That same evening, as I was dismissing the last group of volunteers, one of the volunteers on my team, a man at least 30 years older than me, forcibly pulled me toward him and kissed me on the lips. I did not consent to or welcome this action. I was visibly uncomfortable and humiliated in front of the other volunteers who had looked up to me that day. Suddenly, after a day of feeling so empowered, I felt alone and small, and my strength was just gone. I cannot imagine, after experiencing that kind of harassment, then having to make the difficult decision to hold my employer accountable for the abuse that happened to me under their watch, and to be financially re-victimized when funds owed me through settlement are then withheld by the government as taxes and dwindled down to just about nothing after legal fees. I may then just be left questioning why even bother reporting the incident, why put my career, livelihood, and financial stability at risk. And this realization I know would just leave me feeling completely helpless. But I'm here today testifying because I know I am not helpless. I know that we are not helpless. I'm testifying in solidarity with Ms. Risser because this committee has an opportunity to support victims of sexual harassment. Victims face immense challenges from a system that re-victimizes them when they seek basic care and justice. And House File 3010 is a step toward justice for victims. I urge you to support this bill. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Ryan. That's it for the testifiers. Any member questions? You folks aren't very lively at all. Representative Raleigh, there we go.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. So when we go into the opening of this bill, can the author describe for us, are there any changes if this bill is made into law? For the line where it says, or severance pay, I'm on line 1.11, 1.11, or severance pay to the employee when the settlement includes a non-disclosure agreement. To the author, what happens if there is not a non-disclosure? And as a follow-up to that, does the non-disclosure have to be in place prior to, or is the non-disclosure able to be inserted after the event? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Adelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Raleigh, with this, in terms of how it works is usually the non-disclosure agreement happens during the negotiation. So it would happen as a process there. In terms of whether or not it has to exist for this to happen, It's a good question. That's a good question. And I might have to circle back and talk with our House research staff. I actually do think that's a really good question, Representative Raleigh.
Thank you.
Representative Raleigh, maybe before we go further, maybe nonpartisan staff can help out with that. I don't know. Ms. James.
Actually, Mr. Chair, Ms. James can feel free to answer that if she's got it.
Ms. James.
Mr. Chair and members, I am not sure on that piece. I think the question is, what happens if there is not a non-disclosure agreement? And I don't think that this bill specifies that from my reading, but I would have to look into what the existing what would happen under the existing law.
Thank you, Ms. James. Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And the reason I'm focusing on that one is I want to make sure that we're not getting into a catch-22 type of an event. Without the non-disclosure, this can't happen. But with the non-disclosure, something else may be forced into it. And so, Mr. Chair, that's the reason for the question. I appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Raleigh. And it's probably a reason why this bill is going to judiciary to figure that kind of stuff out. So, anyway, any other member questions? Representative Raleigh, your hand's still up?
Nope, trying to get it down.
Okay, sounds good. Any other member questions? Not seeing anything. I just want to thank Representative Edelson for bringing this bill. I think it's tremendously important and touches on an area that has affected all our lives, but especially women's lives. So thank you, Representative Edelson. Any final comments, Representative Edelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for listening today. And thank you to my constituent, Mrs. Risser, for being here. I know it's not easy to testify in front of a committee. I just wanted to actually highlight, too, just for Representative Raleigh to follow up. I know you definitely studied the bills, and I'm so grateful for how you do that. In 2017, there was a Tax Cut and Jobs Act that really ties how this works in terms of on the federal level to the NDA. And so that we were really kind of seeking that NDA really does buy silence. And so we're trying to figure out how to navigate. But I really do appreciate your feedback on that. And I'm going to look into it. And I thank members for your time today. And I urge you to vote yes.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. Representative Edelson renews her motion that House File 3010 be referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. Mr. Petrie, please take the roll.
Chair Eklund.
Aye.
Chair Eklund, aye. Representative Zhang. Representative Detmer.
Aye.
Representative Detmer, aye. Representative McDonald.
Donald, aye.
Representative McDonald, aye. Representative Berg.
Aye.
Representative Berg, aye. Representative Bliss.
Aye.
Representative Bliss, aye. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Representative Edelson, aye. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Representative Frederick, aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Representative Greenman, aye. Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Nelson, aye. Representative Poston.
Aye.
Representative Poston, aye. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, aye.
Representative Raleigh, aye. Representative Sundin.
Aye.
Representative Sundin, aye. Representative Zhang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang, aye. Mr. Chair, we have 13 ayes and 0 nays.
13 ayes and 0 nays. The bill is on its way to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. Next bill is from Representative Long, House File 4066. I move to refer House File 4066 to the Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee. I also understand that Representative Long has brought an A1 author's amendment. I move to adopt the A1 author's amendment to the House File 4066 to put the bill in the shape the author requires. Any comments from the members? Representative Chair Long, can you please briefly describe the A1 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So we had an informational hearing on this bill in Climate and Energy Committee, and I heard a concern about the application to significantly remodeled structures in the original bill. So this amendment would remove significantly remodeled, and it would limit the bill's application to new construction.
Thank you, Chair Long. Any comments from the members on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the, adopting the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Long, two-year bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With the transition to electric vehicles underway, we need to make sure that buildings have enough charging infrastructure to support this transition. The transition is happening very quickly in the automotive industry. Chrysler has said they will be all electric by 2028. Volvo will be all electric by 2030. General Motors will be all electric by 2035, just to name a few. And new construction buildings for large commercial or multi-unit housing are built to last for many decades. So these buildings will be in existence well into the transition for auto manufacturers towards all electric vehicles. I think that's why a letter of support was submitted to the committee from Auto Manufacturers Association. According to the U.S. Department of Energy, over 80% of electric vehicle charging happens at home. So we need to ensure that the buildings are EV ready so that multifamily tenants can also have access to charging infrastructure. This approach, doing it at the front end when a new building is being constructed, will also save money. It's much cheaper to make sure that an electric panel is large enough, for example, to support electric vehicle charging on the front end than to go back in later and expand the panel. This bill takes the simple approach of asking the Department of Labor and Industry to work with stakeholders to determine what is the appropriate requirement for new construction. So the bill is not prescriptive, and it will let the technical advisory group that is convened by the Department of Labor and Industry work out the details. So I would like now to turn it over to the three testifiers I've asked to come speak on the bill.
Thank you, Chair Long. First testifier, Greg Metz, Program Manager, Construction Plan Review, Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. Mr. Metz, please welcome back to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, and thank you to you and the committee members. My name is Greg Metz. I am one of the program managers for the Construction Codes and Licensing Division of the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. Thanks for the opportunity to testify this afternoon on House File 4066. The department was asked by Representative Long to provide a technical review and comment on the bill draft as it may relate to enforcement of the state building code. Our suggestions included adding a definition of parking facilities, as well as editing portions of Subdivision 16 to clarify the general scoping requirements as to which types of buildings would be affected by the change. Since electric vehicle charging is not currently required in the model building codes we adopt, if passed into law, the Construction Codes Advisory Council would form a technical advisory group, or TAG, consisting of stakeholders and technical experts collaborating in open meetings to develop the specific requirements. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I will be available to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Metz. Next up is Andrew Snope, Legislative and Political Director, IBEW Local 292. Mr. Snope, welcome back to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Eklund, and members of the Labor and Veterans Committee for allowing me to testify today. My name is Andy Snow. I represent the members of IBEW Local 292, the electrical workers. Our members perform work installing and maintaining energy systems all over the state of Minnesota. I'm here today to not only speak on behalf of the IBEW electrical workers who install EV infrastructure, but also a longtime EV owner. 3 out of 4 of my family's vehicles are electric vehicles. 4 out of 5 of my neighbors have electric vehicles. Owning an electric vehicle is gaining popularity. An efficient, reliable electrical vehicle infrastructure is needed in Minnesota. House File 4066 being discussed here today will help to provide future opportunities to prepare for the infrastructure needed for electrical vehicle owners. Where there are opportunities to provide parking in buildings, this bill will encourage the building of EV charging infrastructure. Where this encouragement is most needed is the multi-occupancy homeowner market. As an electrician and a single-family homeowner, building my new level 2 charging system in my home was very easy. For homeowners in multi-family apartments and condominium structures, that option is just not available right now, mostly because of the infrastructure is just not in place to do so. The IBEW typically urges caution in legislating building and mechanical code requirements. This process should be left to the industry participants and advisors. After working with the stakeholders and Representative Long, we are pleased to see this proposal placed in the proper statute, which allows for the adoption procedure through the rulesmaking process advised by the Construction Codes Advisory Council. With that in place, we do support this proposal. Constructing electrical vehicle charging infrastructure will create jobs for the electrical industry and IBEW members. The IBEW provides training to electrical workers not only in Minnesota electrical laws and rules, but also instruct workers specifically with the additional skills needed to install, operate, and maintain EV chargers through our electrical vehicle infrastructure training program, or VEITP. IBEW electrical workers and contractors we work for are ready to get to work on electrical vehicle infrastructure for Minnesotans. Thank you for allowing me the time to testify today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Snow. I'm going to steal a line from my good friend, Chair Sundin. When you get to be a chair, you have the right to butcher somebody's name. So, Pavel Anatovich, owner of GS Motors. Mr. Anatovich, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Pavel Ignatovich. I'm the owner of GS Motors used car dealership. We specialize in selling only electric cars. We've been doing this for over 5 years now, and I learned a lot with the type of customers we sell to and what are the issues for a lot of people. And I just want to talk about the multifamily housing customers. So within the first 2 years since we started, I noticed about 80% of the customers that purchased EVs from us requested a buyback within the first month of ownership, as they realized there was no way for them to really charge the vehicles and being able to use them. So since then, I screen all the customers before they purchase and ask questions about where they live and so on. And I have about 90% of turn downs. I turn people down that live in multi-unit housing that don't have charging infrastructure, because with the experience that I received, I just know it's not going to work. And it's a lot of business that is lost, honestly. And I can also tell that we had quite a few customers that live in the multi-housing units that have charging infrastructure, or at least even an access to just a regular outlet, and zero buyback requests from these customers and zero negative feedback. So with all this experience throughout the years, I can see at least 30% increase in EV sales in Minnesota if we do this new building code for the new multifamily housing or commercial buildings. Thank you so much, and let me know if you have any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Anatovich, for your testimony. Next up, Nick Erickson, Director of Regulatory Affairs, Housing First Minnesota. Mr. Erickson, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nick Erickson. I'm the Director of Regulatory Affairs and Research for Housing First Minnesota. Our organization represents construction firms, subcontractors, trade partners across the construction spectrum, including multifamily construction. Housing First Minnesota also operates Minnesota's largest residential green energy efficiency program, Minnesota's Green Path. Our experts are members and award winners in energy efficient construction. My comments today are rooted not in what this bill does, but more the procedural precedent that this creates. I have already expressed our concerns to Representative Long and have pledged to work with him as this bill moves throughout the legislature. One thing I do want to also note is that this bill does not encourage it mandates. There is a distinct difference between what this bill does and what one of the testifiers did state earlier. Our model building codes in Minnesota are developed by construction experts across a variety of different organizations, depending on which model code entity is presenting the codes. This specific provision was stricken as being out of scope for our energy codes in a recent code review process. The fact that the International Code Council did remove this from the model codes is what's giving us pause today. The legislation would interrupt the model code process and would seek to mandate a provision that was rejected by the trusted building officials and home builders who helped design our state's model energy model codes. And for that reason, this needs to go through a more rigorous review instead of direction from the legislature to mandate this provision. Thank you for your time. And again, we pledge to work with Representative Wong as this bill moves forward. If you have any questions, I can stand for those. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Erickson. Member questions? Representative Raleigh.
Well, we can let, Mr. Chair, we can let Representative Blair, actually, I was going to say, let somebody else go first. I already talked once, but I appreciate it. Looks like there's a bunch jumping in. Mr. Chair, I've got a couple questions. The first one is specifically to the last testifier. We're talking about some mandated code changes, and we know that there's level one types of chargers. Those are the 120-volt chargers. There's level two chargers that goes into the 240 volt. We've got level threes, which are fast chargers. We've got SAE, I think it's 1772. We've got Tesla superchargers. My question is, are we advanced enough in the codes, the building codes specifically, that we're not going to run into a problem of installing the chargers, but then having the industry standards change? Because again, the previous testifier said that the buildings are going to be in place for 20, 30, 40 years. So is it the opinion of the testifiers that we're far enough down the industry standards path that mandating this is not going to cause unintended harm, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Erickson or Mr. Metz, who wants to tackle that one? I see Mr. Snopek raise his hand as well. So Mr. Erickson.
Yeah, I'll be brief. Really what the code is intended to do is to provide an approach for how these systems would be installed in a safe manner. The mandating their use is a different question. I'm not an expert in the specific types and what the industry standardization is, but I would be fair to assume that as we've seen with a lot of technology, there eventually does become some type of standard, but that's just speculation on my part.
Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just from industry experience, we know that the USB standards, and again, this is an electrical type of a standard, even though it's low volt, the USB standards have changed over time. And we know from the various connectors, Mode C, Mini USB and others, that as the standards changed over time, it did cause disruptions in the industry. And so, again, back to my first question, is this bill going to be broad enough that we're not locking any of these buildings into a specific technology? Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Long.
Thank you. Thank you for the question, Representative Raleigh. So, yes, this bill is very flexible. So it does not require a specific technology. It does not even require a specific number. What it does is it puts this question squarely in the regular decision-making process that happens through code-setting process and through the technical advisory groups so that the experts could take a look at what would be the appropriate requirements. And it's not just referring to charging infrastructure. It's, for example, that you're referring to a specific charger. This is also looking at EV readiness. So that may be the raceways that are running out to a place where there may be a charger in the future. Or it's talking about, the possibility of having the electrical panels be large enough. So those are the types of decisions that we are leaving to the technical advisory group. There have been proposals in other states to have a minimum number of chargers like you're talking about. I didn't go with that approach, and that's not what this bill does. This is really leaving it to the technical advisory group to make those determinations and let the experts figure out what would be the appropriate path. Mr. Erickson referred to the federal discussions around the ACC and the code setting process that has not yet included anything on electric vehicles. And that's precisely why we're here, which is that this is a conversation that needs to be taking place and has to happen at the state level. It hasn't happened at the federal level yet. And so we need to be able to move on it as a state. And we do have language in statute right now that requires these types of conversations. We have language for a minimum amount of recycling that buildings have that is at the state level. And so we're just trying to take a look at, you know, what we as a state should be requiring and start that conversation for buildings that are going to last for decades.
Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Long, in preparation for this bill and the testimony, I started doing some research on, you know, the entire supply chain, because we're talking about an endpoint here. Somebody's already purchased the vehicle, they're parking it, now they're charging it, typically at a residential area. I want to back up all the way to the beginning of the supply chain where, you know, industry meets sales, meets this entire flow from, you know, cradle to grave, basically. We know from President Biden, his State of the Union speech, that there is going to be a much greater focus from the president and his directives down to the states that we need to buy American. Do you think that the industry here, because the testimony previously was that Ford Motor Company and others are going to be producing these cars, will the infrastructure be able to handle American-made, basically soup to nuts throughout this entire process? Or are we going to be enacting bills that are going to force us to purchase like nickel from like Russia? Because Russia is the number three producer of nickel in the world right now. And I'm just wondering, how are we going to meet the standards of buying American? And is the industry ready for that right now? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Long, Chair Long.
Thank you for the question, Representative Raleigh. So EV chargers, many are made in America. There's actually a Minnesota company that we heard from in our committee that is an EV charger manufacturer in Minnesota. So, and I think as Mr. Snope mentioned, a lot of the electrical parts and components that this bill would be referring to would be installed by Minnesotans in these buildings. So yes, I think this is a very pro-America, pro-Minnesota jobs bill.
Representative Raleigh.
And to the cars, are the cars able to be produced and their components produced in the United States?
Chair Long.
Thank you, Representative Raleigh. Yes, actually, there's a really large investment that General Motors is making, their biggest investment ever in electric vehicle manufacturing, and including new manufacturing centers in Michigan right now. So there is quite a lot of investment going on in electric vehicle manufacturing in the United States. You know, this is the direction that the automotive industry is headed, and I think that's why we saw the letter of support into our committee from the auto manufacturers, is that we know that they are moving very rapidly towards electric vehicles, and so we just need to be ready as a state so that consumers have the option to purchase them. As you heard from Mr. Anatovich, that there's many customers right now who can't purchase the vehicles even if they want to.
Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a final comment, and then I'll yield back. I just want to make sure that, you know, the United States is not going to get into a situation where we're relying on foreign countries like Russia for the supply chain and putting our national security at risk. And I know this is labor and industry, but I do worry about making sure that we are keeping America safe. And this is the type of small things, because we're talking about infrastructure. These are the small things that I really believe we need to think about to make sure that America is not going to get into a situation where we're being held hostage by foreign powers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Long.
I just thank you, Representative Raleigh. I just wanted to make the quick comment that one really good way to fight back against Russia is to make sure we're not buying more oil, and moving towards electric vehicles is an excellent way to do that.
And drilling here in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I don't think we have any oil in Minnesota.
Representative Dever.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Long, you know, I agree with a lot of things that Representative Raleigh just brought up about, you know, buying from the U.S. And right now we are funding the war that's going on in Europe right now. But anyway, take a look at a question here. Let's say if we were going to build a new state office building right here with a parking ramp, if your bill goes through and is signed by the governor, how many of these stations do we have to have here in our parking ramps here in the Senate and also in the House here?
Chair Long.
Thank you for the question, Representative Detmer. The bill does not specify a number. The bill puts that question to the code-setting process, the technical advisory group that would be convened by Department of Labor and Industry to ask that question about what would be appropriate.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know, I've always felt that the free market would determine, you know, what the needs are for our public in terms of whether it's a car or a truck. I know we have some problems with your heavy-duty trucks having to go electric. That could be a problem. I know I've talked to farmers and people that have businesses, the trucking industry, and that can be a real problem. I think if we just let the free market take its way through the system, we'll see more of this. Thank you, Mr. Representative Long.
Mr. Chair?
Chair Long.
I could just respond briefly. I think we heard from a free market business EV salesperson who really wants to sell more of these vehicles and isn't able to because a lot of the customers that he's trying to sell to don't have the ability to charge. So we're, I think, going to be helping out the free market by creating more consumer choice here.
Mr. Chair, yeah, Mr. Chair, and I've talked to auto dealers myself, and they, from my conversations with them, they feel that they're being forced into this. The dealerships, no, I'm talking about dealerships, not the companies themselves, but the dealerships, because the people in my communities, the demand is still. Pickups and cars and that run on gas. So that's where the dealerships have talked to me about. So thank you.
Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First off, Chair Long, you're correct. We don't have oil in Minnesota, but we do have a big nickel mine in northern Minnesota that our president saw fit to cancel. So yes, we are going to be reliant on Russia. I know that's a discussion for a bigger group, but you know that is a big issue right now for these batteries. Where do we get the rare earth minerals to make them? I do have some questions. You know, when Rep. Detmer stated that we're looking for the free market to do this. You know, there are a carrot and a stick approach, and this is unfortunately a huge stick. Have you given any thought to tax breaks for people to put these in? You know, I come from northern Minnesota, and a lot of our places up there, you know, we're more spread out. I just spoke to my co-op people today, my electrical co-ops, and I just asked them for a small apartment complex. How much would it cost when you're building, how much would it add to this apartment to just put the infrastructure to accept these chargers? And it can run $30,000 or more, depending on the size of the equipment to put in. And that's, you know, in northern Minnesota and in rural Minnesota, that's a lot of money. I do have a problem, you know, and this just kind of, We have been delegating way too many rulemaking abilities to these departments. Now, this one, you know, getting the industry experts in and getting them on a panel, that's probably a good thing. I do have a question on that, Chair Long. Who puts this panel together? Who's going to be involved on it? Is there going to be something that ensures that there's not going to be a conflict of interest, you know, that these people – you know, aren't doing it for their own benefit.
Chair Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Mr. Metz could speak to the technical side of pulling these groups together.
Mr. Metz, please.
I can. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Long. The technical advisory groups are put together by the Construction Code Advisory Council, which is made up of a number of stakeholders throughout various industries and construction groups representative of the state of Minnesota. So the basis of the group is wide. The technical advisory groups have been picked out of various stakeholder groups. The meetings that are held for the technical advisory groups are all open to the public. So people are able to participate in the process to the extent that they choose. And it's a public and open process. Thank you, sir.
Representative Bliss.
All right, yeah, and I appreciate that. I just wish that there was some sort of mechanism where we could have final approval on this. And unfortunately, again, when we go to delegation of authority, when we delegate the legislative responsibilities of the legislature to these commissions and departments, we lose a lot of authority. I have had several conversations just in the last few days about rules that different departments put into place. And, you know, we have no recourse on that, unfortunately, when it's made until somebody brings it up, and then we could maybe change it in law. I just wish we would have a little bit more authority to change it prior to it going into law. I guess that's it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, Representative Long, it seems that your bill requires and relies a lot on what will happen in the future. So a lot of people, a lot of uncertainties. You know, people in my district want to know, why is it the, what do you think, what would you say to the statement as to why, what role is it the government to be providing the electrical for electrical cars? Why is it the government's role in doing that? We don't provide light bulbs for their cars. We don't provide car washes or gas for their car. So how would you respond to that?
Chair Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative McDonald. So as we're rapidly moving towards an electric vehicle future for the automakers, we know that 80% of people are going to charge at home. And so if that's where most people are charging, then we need access to infrastructure, and infrastructure is the government's job. So we, I think, need to help make sure that consumers have the choice to be able to purchase vehicles that they want to purchase. And we know that these buildings are going to last for many decades. So if we're not doing this right now and helping people have those options, then it's going to be much more expensive in the future to be able to make those retrofits of these buildings.
Representative McDonald.
Well, I suppose that's an answer. Certainly, it's not the answer my folks who don't think the government's role is to answer this. But I got another question for you, Chair Long, is what would there be any kind of stipulation that would no member can be affiliated with the with an entity who could profit from this?
Chair Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative McDonald. I don't know exactly what you're thinking, but I could defer to Mr. Metz about any conflict of interest policies that they have for setting up technical advisory groups.
Mr. Metz, any comments?
It's the role of the Construction Codes Advisory Council to do the final selection for the technical advisory group members, and that's part of the public process. So if there were any conflict of interest, I would like to think that it would come out in that process.
Representative McDonald.
All right, that's appropriate. That's good enough for me. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Jean.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Long, I just wanted to thank you for bringing up this bill and all your supporters that have come to speak on this. You know, it's something that's going to be good for the future of this state, the future of this country. I know we've made in the past, you know, Eisenhower administration, you know, we invested in the highways, we invested in infrastructure, and now we need to invest in this. And, you know, we're looking to invest in broadband with health partnerships of, you know, government and private entities, and I think this is the way to go, and I really appreciate your leadership on this issue. Thank you.
Representative McDonald, did you have another question?
No, sorry, sir. I'll mute myself and take that up, lower that.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Another example why I think these things should be in person versus on Zoom, but that's okay. We
play the I would concur. Yes.
Play the hands were dealt. So before I go to Representative Long for Chair Long for his final comments, I want to make a couple. I keep hearing about free market. I think our companies have shown that free market is talking, and Chevy is going to be fully electric by 2035. Chair Long read off a few other manufacturers, so free market is definitely working the way it's supposed to. Chair Long, final comments to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Eklund. The only comment I'll make is just that I'm trying hard not to be the heavy stick, as Representative Bliss mentioned. This is trying very hard just to make sure that we are putting this process into the existing code setting process that folks are comfortable with, they have used in the past, to a technical advisory group that will put this to the experts. I don't want to be the one who's saying, you know, X number of spots in this type of building. I think that is the for the technical advisory group to be making those determinations. But if we don't do this, then we're just going to have a lot of Minnesotans who don't have the ability to purchase electrical vehicles. The free market isn't going to take care of this. We know that this is moving very fast, and buildings are being built now that are going to last for decades. So we need to get ahead of this, and these are the types of policy decisions that I think are appropriately in our shoes.
Thank you, Chair Long. I renew my motion that House File 4066, as amended, be referred to the Climate, Energy, Finance, and Policy Committee. Mr. Petrie, please take the roll.
Chair Eklund.
Aye.
Chair Eklund, aye. Representative Zhang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang, aye. Representative Detmer.
No.
Representative Detmer, no. Representative McDonald.
McDonald, no.
Representative McDonald, no. Representative Berg. Representative Berg, aye. Representative Bliss.
No.
Representative Bliss, no. Representative Edelson. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Representative Frederick, aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Representative Greenman, aye. Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Nelson, aye. Representative Poston.
No.
Representative Poston, no. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, no.
Representative Raleigh, no. Representative Sundin.
Aye.
Representative Sundin, aye. And Mr. Chair, we have 7 ayes and 5 nays.
7 ayes and 5 nays. House File 4066, as amended, is on its way to Climate, Energy, Finance, and Policy Committee. Members, I'm now going to turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Zhang. Vice Chair Zhang, it's all yours.
Right. Thank you, Chair Eklund. Next up, we have House File 4018. With Representative Nelson. Representative Nelson, you want to introduce your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 4018, this is an informational hearing because currently we do not have it in our possession, this committee. It's in the possession of the Pension Commission, where it was heard the other night. The reason I asked to have a hearing in this committee is a portion of this bill is Section 6 of this bill creates another exemption from the PELRA laws of a certain positions. And in this case, it's unclassified positions in the State Board of Investment. And members, back in 2006, the State Board of Investments, or the SBI, created a salary administration plan to provide compensation to the SBI employees or professional investment staff. The staff in 2019, the legislature ratified and updated the salary plan for the SBI. Among the other things in the updated plan, they added three new staff positions or professional investment staff jobs, and they created to provide a pathway for entry level employees in the investment professionals to move up the board from beginning levels up to a higher level. When they created these new jobs, however, they named them, and I guess there's a naming process that goes on with this with the state. They named them investment analysts, and they have junior, which would be the beginning level, intermediate, and senior level investment analysts. However, when they did this and after the plan was approved, they realized that there were employees represented by MAPE that fit into jobs that were also called investment analysts. And there, and throughout the state of Minnesota, there's investment analyst one, excuse me, two, investment analyst three. Because there's some confusion in the plan. But what this is, what this bill is doing is putting these people that work for the SBI and only the SBI into a non or unclassified job setting. And for members that don't understand the difference, a classified job position is one that's that has Pell rights. They have the right to form a union. They have the right to bargain that way. Where the unclassified members are members that are not in a union and not and are more management type plant people. And like I said, that's what they tried to create. And there's a little bit of ambiguity there about that. But basically what this plan does is it's basically exempting what affects us is Section 6, which is creating another exemption. This would be eighth exemption of people that are jobs that are not part of PELRA. And that's the, basically the bill in a nutshell. And I have Mr. Mulay from the State Board of Investment and Mr. Devin Bruce here from MAPE to answer any questions. But again, that's what the bill does. And that's why we're hearing it here, because things that deal with PELRA, we need to deal with in the Labor Committee. And again, when I saw this bill and we first heard it, and I saw it in pensions, that I realized that it would have to come here. And rather than bring the whole pension bill here, we have this bill hearing here today, and get it out of the way before the first deadlines. So members, that's the bill, and I stand for any questions.
Members, any questions or comments from the members? Representative Detmer.
You're muted, sir. I can't
hear you. Sorry, you're muted. Representative Detmer.
I get it again. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson. When you get this bill the way you want it, are we going to hear it again in this committee?
Representative Nelson.
I don't believe so, no. Like I said, what we're doing is adding this position and on 6.10, Section 6 of the bill, it's adding the eighth exemption, unclassified positions in the State Board of Investment. So I don't believe it needs to come back here after we hear it.
Representative Detmer.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Nelson, are there any other classifications that we maybe should be looking at too?
Representative
like
Nelson.
We're doing here?
Oh, sorry.
Mr. Chair and Representative Detmer, this bill just deals with the employees that work for the State Board of Investment and under their compensation plan, the unclassified people under their compensation plan. It doesn't deal with anybody else. And if there are other ones in other parts of government that we need to deal with, they would have to bring another bill forward to do that. This is just dealing with the people that work for the State Board of Investment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Detmer. Okay.
Thank you.
All right, seeing no other questions or comments, no hands being raised. Representative Nelson, you wanna pose your presentation?
Again, as I said, this is dealing with a very select number of people, positions. Because of the confusion in the two positions with identical names that it's created confusion, the State Board of Investment has not been able to hire these employees, and this bill would allow them to hire these employees again at entry-level position, and then as they increase in their ability and their experience, move them up into the higher positions, would be a path for advancement for these people. So that's what this bill does, is by putting these employees in exempt from PELRA, that they would be able to hire these employees and hire the staff.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. With that, is the informational hearing on House File 4018. And with that, we will be adjourned, and the next meeting will be tomorrow at 3:00. All right, and with that, we are adjourned, members.